Hey guys, what's up and welcome to another episode of Sheer Strength Labs podcast with me, your fitness coach, Josh Baker. Today on the show, I've got Jonathan Ross, two-time personal trainer of the year and functional training expert, and he's going to be coming on to talk to us about core training and the myths of the common crunch. Before we get into the episode with Jonathan, make sure you leave a review on the iTunes store, please. It is a massive help to us as we peaked in the top 10 of fitness podcasts in all of iTunes. And so your reviews really, really help us. If you do leave a review, make sure you leave it under your name and then go and hit up Sheer Strength at the Facebook page, Sheer Strength Labs. There's a couple of threads on there that if you let them know that you subscribed using the I subscribe tagline, then you will be able to win yourself a free tub of creatine. And we have spoken about how fantastic that supplement is many times in this podcast. So I guess really it's time to get into today's content. So without further ado, here is Jonathan. Hey, Jonathan, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on today. If we could just kick off by giving the listeners a little background information on who you are and why we've got you on to talk today.
I will do that. So welcome, everyone. And it's exciting for me to be a guest on your podcast, Joshua. It's really great to see the reach that you're getting and also the quality and the authenticity that you bring to sharing just quality information that helps people live to the best of their ability. So for me, my origin story, as it were, in fitness really got started in 1995. My father was 424 pounds, which is almost 200 kilos, and he died of obesity-related complications, and that kind of lit my spark for helping people live a better life, and that was really just a powerful motivator for me. It was a way to turn something that's tragic into something positive and touch a lot of lives for the better. And at the time, it was great because I really didn't know what I wanted to do for a living. So it gave me some clarity and focus and some direction and drive to live a purposeful life. And I'm glad I found that. So it's kind of it's an odd thing to have a sense of happiness around a tragedy. But in life, I think, you know, we can do no better than figuring out ways to turn some of the more tragic and difficult periods of our lives into something for better for ourselves and for others as well. So that's kind of where I got my start in the fitness industry. And then from there, it's really just been a journey of starting off as just a trainer and teaching a few classes and ultimately realizing that that wasn't enough for me. It didn't fill me up and satisfy me in terms of reaching people and just sharing more information. So subsequent to that, I just really decided that my real passion is sharing information. And so I'm what I have heard termed an infopreneur, in that I just really have a lot of ideas and information and do consulting, speaking, writing. It's video work. I don't really care. It's just essentially sharing information through as many channels as possible that helps people get the most out of their efforts to maintain and pursue fitness.
Awesome, man. That's it's incredible. And I know that you're being very modest here, but I think you've got a couple of accolades behind you as well. Two-time personal trainer of the year winner.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, you're being very modest there, buddy. That's a pretty prestigious and awesome thing to be recognized for in an industry of millions. There are millions of us around the world. So,
well, thank you for bringing that up. It's kind of one of those things that every success for me is just the beginning of the next challenge in a good way. So everything I do that brings me some accolades, I really see it as just a further opportunity to help more people. So I tend to go, okay, that's great. But for me, it's not so much a chance to take a little victory lap as it is to say, well, that's awesome. And that's just hopefully going to give me more opportunities to do what I love to do, which is to share information that helps enhance the quality of people's lives. So thank you for that compliment.
Oh, you're welcome, buddy. And the information that you love sharing, you're pretty well astute on core and functional training, right? That's why we've got you to come on and talk today.
Yeah, it was exciting. I got into the industry, of course, in the late 1990s, and at that time it was a lot of machine-based training, which isn't a bad thing necessarily. I believe most pieces of equipment have value if they're applied sensibly, but it was really focused on that kind of single muscle training, and there really wasn't much done with the core. And so within a short time, I discovered some different strategies. One that was really impactful for me was Reebok University's Reactive Neuromuscular Training Program, and it really touches on some of those aspects, the whole idea of that proximal strength equals distal power, which that's kind of a fancy way to say that the classic way is you can't fire a cannon out of a canoe. So the idea is that if you're strong in the center of your body, you'll have a powerful response at your extremities. And the way I like to kind of communicate that to the general public, and just for, as an easy way for everyone to understand it, is to simply say that your body is like a whip, where your trunk and torso is your handle and your arms and your legs are like the tail or the lash of a whip. So if you have a strong, stable handle, when you go to strike with the whip, you'll have a nice response if you have a strong, stable handle. But if you don't, you don't get a nice response out of the whip.
That's a very cool analogy there. I'm super intrigued. Okay, so I guess let's kick off things talking a little bit about everyone trains core because they think it's going to give them those 6-pack, 8-pack abs, right? We see everyone hammering the core in the gym or training their abs through the roof, but I'm sure there's some common mistakes that we see, and there's been a lot of controversy about, is a crunch effective throughout the fit media that's around and available to everyone? So maybe we can just clarify about crunches and then move on to some flaws and flaws we see in the core training itself.
Excellent. And as a preface to that statement, there is the one big group that you identified, which is that group that, you know, goes in and hammers away on core exercises and ab exercises trying to achieve a certain look. But there's an increasingly large number of people that are seeking injury prevention and actually seeking prevention of back pain and just better movement. So there's a growing body of people that are seeking that as well. And those two things can kind of coexist. I believe that if you train the abs well, just like other muscles, if you train them properly, then you'll get the right results. Kind of a form follows function. The shape of the body starts to follow what you do with it most often. And if you make the body more capable, you also can make it better looking. So get in more specifically into the controversy around crunches. I think it's part of our tendency in the fitness industry to do what I call keep riding the pendulum back and forth. So we don't have this ability to seemingly get off in the middle of the pendulum swing. We like to go from one extreme to the other, and you see it with a number of things in terms of cardio. And so there was a time where cardio was the end all be all of human existence 20 years ago, and now it's never do cardio again. And then I think that's a bit of an overreaction. And then there's also the hugely cushioned running shoe to the barefoot movement, where they call it natural, not really natural to run barefoot on asphalt and concrete, because that's not what our ancestors did. And so there's this tendency to go from one extreme to the other, and we see it now again with ab training. So 20, 30 years ago, everyone was proud of the fact that they would roll out of bed and do 200 crunches in an effort to get their midsection looking better, and it infrequently did not produce the result that they were looking for. And because of some issues with technique, or maybe some overuse of that exercise, it certainly can create some problems, just like too much of anything can potentially cause harm. So then there's this overreaction, where this idea that we should never do crunches again or our spines will explode has come into play. And I think it's a little bit extreme. I think there's value in everything. And human physiology is so complex and so diverse, it's really hard to say in black and white terms that any one thing is or is not as an absolute correct. So kind of a quick comment I like to make about all these things that have to do with extremism is that I really believe extremism is for lazy thinkers. So it's people who are really unwilling or unable to do the hard work of living in the gray area. And when you get more and more deeply into the fitness world, you understand that almost everything is a gray area. And just kind of learning when something is and isn't appropriate is really the secret to success with anyone, because one person's good choice of exercise will not be the right one for someone else. So if you'd like, I can go into some more of the specific controversies around the crunch itself.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Let's clear some of that up and dive into some of them. That'd be fantastic.
Okay, so it's really, I think probably the top two ones are the whole idea of should you do crunches at all, and is people scared to do them. So in the practical sense, I just want to put the idea out there to any fitness professionals listening to this, that if you kind of take an extreme stand, and you have, picture yourself in a gym, and you have someone coming up to you, and you have someone ask you, say, hey, what can I do to get my core in shape? You know, can you show me how to do crunches? And then you see this as an opportunity to launch into this manifesto of being anti-crunch. Well, that person's probably going to shut off fairly quickly, because what they're looking for is someone to show them how to do the exercise.
Yeah.
And if you try to make it more of a political statement about crunches, they're probably just going to kind of nod, and then when you're done talking, they're going to go find someone else who's maybe less well-educated on technique than you are, and will actually go ahead and do crunches with that person. So I'd rather have you go ahead and explore that gray area with that person and maybe show them how to do them, and then explain why maybe they would want to balance some of their training. But then, looking at the specifics of the controversy around the crunch itself, what's interesting is that we like to have everything be research-based, but unfortunately research, as we know, we can use studies to prove or disprove almost anything, and sometimes the same study depending on the lens through which we look at the data. You know, I'm a trained scientist, I guess. My college degree is in astronomy, so I like to say I used to study stellar bodies and now I build them. So I kind of try to not stay too deeply into the research for too long. I kind of like to wade into the research pool and come back out, because I'm really into the practical side. I just like being in the trenches with people, delivering information, and just giving them the practical implications of some of the research. So now what you're seeing is that with the controversies around the crunch, a lot of the research has been done on pig spines. And the reason that's done is that the pig spine is very similar to the human spine and as far as how it's constructed. So the researchers often take a dead pig spine, they put it into an apparatus and put it through 8,000 or 10,000 or maybe 12,000 cycles of spinal flexion repeatedly. Now there's some things that happen when you do that, and so you go through essentially it's one big set of 8,000 or 12,000 reps. Pretty fascinating. We would never do that in the gym, first of all. So you go, wait a minute, I would never do a set that big in the gym. Couldn't even do it if I wanted to. Didn't have the time, didn't have the ability. So the second issue is that dead tissue doesn't rehydrate. So the discs of your spine are like sponges, and then when you push on them, that you're squeezing fluid out of the sponge, and then when you release the pressure, they expand, and because your body is essentially a fluid environment, the sponge will automatically pull in new hydration. And that doesn't happen with dead tissue, and that some of that enhanced hydration in the disc is also what helps them have a lower likelihood of injury when they experience stress. So the third thing is that dead tissue doesn't respond to a training stimulus. So number one, we have this massively long set that we would never do in a gym. And we have dead tissue, which doesn't rehydrate. And then we also have tissue which is not given time or doesn't even have the capability, in the case of dead tissue, to respond to a training stimulus. So you add all that up and you create conditions in which you are almost by design creating an environment in which you're going to show harm into that tissue, and then you deem that crunches are unsafe to do. In the real world, where someone might do two sets of 20 reps for a total volume of 40 reps versus 12,000 that might be used in a study.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point that you've made there. I've seen a lot of the, I want to say, crunch bashing posts out there by people, you know, like people losing their cool on social media about the crunch. So it's very interesting that I never really thought about the pig spine and it being dead tissue, and I didn't know that there was 8 to 12,000 repetitions in a row, which if you say that to anyone with common sense, they're just like, oh, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, I think if you took a dead knee and you did 8,000, 12,000 reps on it, you might find that there would be some damage. Now that, after this comes out, we might have, both of us might take some heat from the anti-crunch crowd, but I'm no huge fan of crunches. Like I always say, I don't think they're the second coming of Jesus, but I don't think they're the Antichrist either. I really don't have a particular love of them, but I really don't see the need to have a particular hatred of them. I think they were overused for so long, and because everyone wants to have that nice looking ab area, they got overused. And certainly anything overused or done with bad technique, yeah, there is the potential for some pathology to work its way into the spine if you do too much of them and you do them incorrectly and you don't balance out all the strength of the muscles around the core. And so that, yes, they can be used for harm, but it doesn't mean they are inherently harmful. That's an important distinction to make.
Sure. And so I guess moving on from the era of the crunch being the dominant core exercise, I guess next up on the scene was everyone started doing planks, right?
Yes.
Like everybody, it's like the staple of what do you do for your core? I plank. Like plank is my exercise. How long can you plank for? Now I know that you have some views on why you think that this movement is so excessively overused.
Yeah, I wrote an article late last year called "What Comes After Planks." So anybody interested in reading that can just Google it with my name, and you should find it pretty easily.
Yeah,
for the American Council on Exercise.
And we'll pop it in the show notes. The essential idea
is that if we think of what life is, what's your favorite activity to do?
Oh man, I love playing any type of sport, like soccer or football, anything.
Right, playing any type of sport. Ask.
Yeah.
Anyone else around you? It might be hiking. It might be playing tennis. It might be playing with my kids. Playing with my grandkids. Taking the dog for a walk. Gardening. And what's this? The underlying common denominator in all of those things is that there is movement occurring. So life is movement, and the things that we love to do, the things that bring enjoyment and a sense of satisfaction to life, involve movement. They do not involve the absence of it. There's no one has a hobby or an activity that involves staying still. And so just holding a plank for long periods of time is not the best use of training time in a world where most people are pressed for time. I'm not saying it does harm. Again, I don't believe in extreme views, so I would never go so far as to say that doing a long plank is harmful. I just don't believe it's the best use of training time in that, why do we do planks at all? The goal, if you ask anyone, why do you plank, they go, I don't know, core stability, or have some kind of generic response. But why do you want any of that? Why do you want core strength, core stability? Why do you want that? It's to be able to do things well, and not hurt yourself, whatever those things are. But it's in the interest of getting moving and being active, love and joy for living through movement and things that you enjoy. So if we just do a longer and longer plank, I think at the time I wrote the article, the current world record for a plank was 3 hours, 7 minutes, and 15 seconds. And that's since, I just heard last week when I was giving a talk about ab training, someone told me that the current world record is now over 5 hours.
Yeah,
I think it's, you know, where does it stop? It just kind of, I call it like staying in year one of school. So, if, you know, you go to year one of school, you learn your alphabet, you learn your ABCs, and if you stay there forever, you're in your 30s and 40s, you're still in first grade, still in year one, you're learning all your ABCs. Well, if you never learn anything more than that, then you're not really getting the most out of your education. So we learn letters to build words, words to build sentences. We learn how to build sentences to tell stories, and stories are how we have an impact. So in much the same way with exercise, we perform a plank to develop the ability to create and control full body stability, to teach the muscles of the center of the body to work in good coordination and timing with the outer sections of the body to both create movement when we need it and prevent movement when we don't. So then once we can do that, once we have that basic skill, it's time to get out of first grade and, you know, get out of first grade of plank school and just start moving. So we go, I like to do either 10-second sets of maybe 3 or 4, or even just if it's a static plank, no longer than about 30 seconds. And then once someone can do that with good form, get the plank moving. Start to move the body, because that's life. You either shift the weight, maybe lift a limb, actually travel the plank. You walk sideways, you walk forward. There's endless varieties for how to get a plank moving, and I think that's a better use of training time. And again, I want to be sure anybody listening, I'm not saying that a longer plank is a bad thing. What I'm saying is that in a world where I often deal with people who say, well, I need you to design a program for me, and I've got 4 days a week for 45 minutes, and that's it. That's all they can devote to training. Is holding a static plank for 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes, is that the best use of training time given the parameters that I'm given by that individual? Is that the best use of the training time? That's the question I'm always asking myself when implementing anyone's program. Is this the most effective use of the time?
Okay, so my next question is then, I guess, obviously there are far more effective uses of time. So how can, or what would some more effective exercises be? Once someone has required the set of skills that they can do the plank for 30 seconds or 4 or 5 sets of 10-second planks, what would our next progression be there, where you say get the plank moving? How can they logically progress onto something?
Sure. Sure. If we started in a good plank position, which is as you know, if you've ever seen anyone who's new to exercise do a plank, they don't even really know what good plank technique is. They really think it's just fighting gravity while they're face down. So let's just start with the assumption that someone starting through their feet and actually using their legs, hips, and then their upper body to make a good solid plank position. Then from there, what we can do is begin to shift the body weight side to side. So you shift the body weight more over one elbow than the other. You can also shift front to back by simply extending and then again flexing the ankles. So you're actually just translating the body through space a little bit side to side and front to back. Then you can work on lifting a limb. It's probably a little easier to lift a foot. Then maybe lift an elbow. It's a bit more demanding because then you're supporting the body weight with a single arm. You can then lift the foot and start to move it out to the side. Put the foot down, move it out to the side. And then you can start to move the body, actually walking, doing what's called a traveling plank. Just like we would do a traveling lunge, you could actually walk forward and backward, walk sideways, and lots of different ways. You can then make the plank more explosive and do faster movement, do things like plank jacks and all kinds of rotational variations and large body weight shifting variations and single hand or single elbow planks where you're actually also moving. And so the sky's the limit with progressions. And you know, I like to treat the abs like every other muscle in the body. Typically when we feel like, especially if we're doing like more of a hypertrophy training model, you know, we typically keep the reps somewhere between the maybe the low end if we're focusing a little more on strength, but like a 4 to 5, maybe no more than 20 or so. So I tend to treat the abs the exact same way. So once my abilities are getting to the point where I can do a sort of relatively high number of repetition, then I'm looking for that increase in demand. So I add a new layer of challenge in there, either by moving a limb, moving the body. So it's kind of moving the center of gravity or moving one of the extremities. This is kind of the general way to summarize some of the challenge options you can use in a plank.
So that's interesting. Just like any other body part, you know, say we were train or say movement, say we were training a bench press or a squat or a deadlift and we were looking to increase our totals, we would be working in progressive overload, right? So we'd be keeping a consistent marker of where we're at and trying to progressively increase each week. So effectively that's what you're saying is really relevant to be doing with the abdominals as well.
Yeah, I think it's important to stop treating the abs like they're special, because they're not. I mean, they're in a special location because of the way the body stores fat, right? So there's this first in, last out approach. You start gaining body fat. It typically starts in the central areas of the body because it's efficient biologically for us to carry extra weight there. So then as we start to gain more weight, it starts to go out to the extremities. We start to lose it. If we've added a lot of body fat, it starts at the outer parts of the body and works its way back in, you know, so you start to see the changes in the central regions of the body last. So when you're getting to your highest levels of fitness, that's when you see it the most, is around the midsection. So for better or for worse, that's why we've put such a spotlight on the abdominal muscles, but they're really just muscles. So they should be governed by the same rules that govern other muscles in terms of overload and stress and recovery and the specific adaptation to impose demands idea, where you want it to get stronger, you have to bring a challenge to it and then give it time to recover.
Cool. And I guess one thing that's always kind of gray is, so I might flip it off a little bit here, but talking about progression and overload and stuff, is there's a lot of confliction out there between training abs weighted and training body weight only. What's your views on that?
I think both have value. I think for the person who wants to see very visible abdominals, like ones that pop out, not just be lean and have, you know, kind of baseline levels of definition, but the kind of individual, like for example, your photo, people find you online, you see those kind of abdominals, you typically would want to do some weighted training and some very, you know, heavier, I don't mean heavy, like 100-pound crunches or anything like that with a 100-pound dumbbell on your chest, but just you bring the load high enough that the demand is such that you do a relatively low number of repetitions, just like you would for a typical hypertrophy training model, because we want that kind of popping out of the muscle. So we do want to hypertrophy the abdominals, just like we would want to do with any other muscle that we would want to really develop from a size perspective. So I think that kind of training, someone with those kind of goals, that would warrant more of an overload perspective. The person who just maybe wants general fitness and just have nice lean abdominals, but not ones that really want to pop out really far, then they would they could kind of go either way with it. They could use a little bit of load. They could use body weight only. So again, it's usually goal specific. I don't usually don't believe there's one answer that will be a yes or a no for all of humanity. It's very specific to the individual and often dictated by their goals and their current training status as far as where they're starting the program. Are they a brand new exerciser or have they been exercising for years and are just trying to take things to the next level?
Okay, cool. So we have a lot of guys listening to this show who their training goals are hypertrophy and physique and the way they look. And a lot of them, the pinnacle of that is having abs. The six-pack is the pinnacle of the physique, right? It's in the center. It's the thing that's most popularized through media channels, magazines and stuff. So let's see if we can get some advice from you, Jonathan, on how they could go about setting up a training routine. If they're an average trainer who can commit to 4 to 5 sessions a week of an hour, how would we go about setting up? And they've got no prior injuries to the back or anything. How would we go about setting up an effective ab training routine for them?
Okay, what I like to do is to differentiate ab exercises in two very broad categories.
Sure.
And that is whether they primarily train using stability or mobility. So that means are they featuring primarily the objective of having the abdominals maintain stability, as in prevent movement or only allow a very small amount of movement, or is an exercise's primary characteristic to create mobility, so you would see an actual change in length of a lot of the abdominal muscles. Those are two very broad distinctions. Now, most exercises will feature some of both, but it's simply an indication of which one is the primary characteristic on an exercise. So, for example, just really in easy terms, a crunch is a mobility exercise, a plank is a stability exercise. So, in general, I like to differentiate exercises along those two broad categories. Then what I would do is every ab training segment, so of the total workout program, every ab training portion would have 4 to 6 exercises based on the equipment, the training level of the individual, but at least two of those would be falling into each category. So if I was using 4 exercises, I would have 2 stability and 2 mobility exercises. If I was using 5 or 6 total exercises, I could have 3 and 3 or 2 and 4, but at least 2 are always, you always have at least 2 from the stability category and at least 2 from the mobility category. So that's just a general approach to the ab training. Now, what I will do typically with putting the abdominals into the bigger program, because there's a school of thought out there which I do tend to support as far as on the days when we're doing our heaviest bilateral training, like really heavy squats, heavy deadlifts, that kind of stuff. It's important, I believe, to maintain the strength of the abs first. We wouldn't want to pre-fatigue doing those. So I would tend to go ahead and put those at the end of the training program, which is kind of what the quote-unquote rules of ab training are. So I always, you know, put rules in quotes because I always think rules are good, but they're also more guidelines. And there's a quote I have in the book, Abs Revealed, where this is more of a life philosophy of mine, is that blind adherence to the rules is for those who aren't smart enough to know when to break them. And so that's
very cool.
The goal of ab training is to make sure it gets done. So then some people will say, oh, if I do them at the end, you know how it goes. Sometimes people, oh, I kind of run out of time. I skip them. So I go ahead and say, well, on the heavier days, we want to do them after the heavier lifts, the heavier bilateral lifts. But on lighter days where you're doing more explosive movements, and if you're not doing explosive movements with lighter weights, you should be, because explosive movement always means sort of lighter weight. And then we have maybe if you're doing any unilateral training, like a single arm shoulder press versus a bilateral overhead shoulder press, that's when I would probably do the ab training first, because the load is lighter, we can actually safely pre-fatigue the muscles. And it also changes the training stimulus a little bit, in that since these exercises are maybe faster and potentially more unilateral, they do provide more of an inherent core challenge, even if it's something like a single arm dumbbell row or a single leg squat or some kind of lunge variation. If we pre-fatigue the abs with our ab exercises first, number one, we make sure we get them done. We can put a little more effort into them because we are fresher in the workout, and we have less general fatigue in our body, and then they actually may get a little bit of a higher training stimulus because we've pre-fatigued them before doing the rest of the resistance training. So I will actually, most commonly with someone who has these goals that you just identified, I would actually alter it from days of doing heavier lifting where they do the ab exercises after the core lifts, and then it would be putting the ab exercises first on days where they're doing the lighter unilateral, heavier, not heavier, but the lighter, more explosive movements. So that's kind of the general approach I would use.
Okay, cool. And how many times a week is sufficient for ab training and for core training? What's a sufficient amount? Because, again, there's people that say go 2 times a week post, like you said, post-workout. We've just discussed how to split the training up, but how many times a week should they be hitting it? Is it after every session or before every session that we talked about, whether it's heavy lifts or lighter explosive lifts, or do they limit it to like 3 sessions a week? How would we set that up?
Well, that's an excellent question, and it has a couple of interesting answers. One is that, of course, we have to keep in mind that it is true that the abs tend to recover faster than some other muscles in the body because they are focused heavily on posture, so they're actually used a lot all day long, whether we realize we're using them or not. They have a very low level of activity kind of all day long, so they're built for faster recovery. The other key question is that, is someone doing more of the heavier loaded training? Is there a bit more of a hypertrophy response in the muscles? Maybe we need a little more recovery under those circumstances. But the key question is, you know, that how often can I train the abs? A lot of people seem to want to train them more often, and what I've found is that even though you can train them more often, why would you want to? Kind of like if you come up with a good analogy, the way I always explain it is to people, I say, look, if you could wash your car every day, you'd have a really nice looking car, but who wants to go through the effort of washing your car every day? It's kind of a pain, you know, even if you pay someone to do it yourself, it's a time-consuming job. So you could do that every day, but why would you want to? So I would say let's use the minimum effective dose. So if I was doing like, for example, a 4-day-a-week routine, if I was doing 2 days a week of a bilateral total body program and 2 days a week of a unilateral total body program, I would probably train abs on all 4 of those days. But there's going to be enough variety in the exercise choice that we're not going to repeat a single movement pattern over and over and over again. And then as a side note, to really expand on and sort of clarify some of what we were discussing earlier with crunches, what I like to do with crunches is we make them a little bit less focused on just that main rectus abdominis muscle, the one that's running down the middle that everyone sees, in that I always try to make sure we have either an asymmetrical load. Like, for example, if you're doing a squat or a crunch on a stability ball, you stick your arm out to the side, or you actually shift your center of mass over. So what that does, yes, you're still creating the same movement of a crunch, but you're activating a lot more of the core muscles, which I typically define as anything between the hips and the armpits. So everything from the hips to the pits, really easy way for anyone to understand where the core muscles are. So it's pretty much your trunk and your hips. And so then if we do that, if we shift some of the center of gravity off, either by moving the actual center of gravity of the torso a little bit sideways or sticking an arm out to the side, even if you're just doing a crunch on the ground, you create that lateral shift and that need to prevent the rotation. So you're actually stimulating and turning on a little more muscle. And by spreading out the load of the exercise across more and more abdominal muscles, we increase the benefit and we tend to decrease the hammering away on that one muscle that maybe gets overused with crunches themselves. So it's really by spreading out the training load. I could say you could train abs probably more than 4 days a week if you wanted to, but that would be my maximum. To kind of close up the answer to your question and say my maximum, I think, would be 4 days a week. I wouldn't see a need to train them more than that. If someone feels like they want to, that's a clear indication that they're not training hard enough on those other days. Because if you do something hard enough, you don't want to do it too often.
Yeah. Okay, cool. That's a solid answer there, Jonathan. I know there's some other questionable exercises which you wanted to have a little dive into when we spoke before the show. There's some other things out there, not only the crunch, there's some other stuff out there that is it really the most effective thing to be using? And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are and what they are.
Yeah, one of the classic ones that I see, to me, from my way of thinking, is far more risky than a crunch is, but I just don't think anyone's actually quote-unquote studied it, because, you know, I guess the minute somebody with a PhD studies something, everybody, it kind of has the seal of approval on it. But the exercise that's been done in gyms forever, and I remember seeing it even before I became a trainer, and I remember doing it before I ever became a trainer, where you have one person lying on the ground face up, and the partner stands near their head, and the person on the ground holds the feet, holds onto the ankles of the person that's standing up, and then the person standing up starts to throw their legs forward. It's kind of this exercise where it's almost like this battle of wills between my ability, if I'm standing, to throw your legs and your ability to stop your legs from falling towards the ground.
Yeah.
But the problem is that my upper body strength as the standing partner will always be far in excess of the stopping power of especially the smaller intraspinal muscles of the person on the ground. So what happens is often the hip flexors will lock in place because they're powerful, and it pulls the hips forward aggressively, which pulls the lower back into an aggressive and very rapid anterior tilt. So to me, that puts way more potential stress on the spine than something like a crunch. For even a very, like, I don't think you have to do these for very long if you do them poorly to notice some discomfort and some potential irritation of some of the spinal tissues. So that's one exercise right there. There's another one that you see a lot, which is, and this one's a little popular, so it's just, again, it's not one of my favorites, and I would just encourage everyone to think through it. It's the standing side bends. You might hold a heavy dumbbell or a cable,
yeah,
and you actually let one shoulder drop towards the floor while the other one falls down. It just puts a lot of aggressive stress when you kind of give up to the weight. So if you let gravity kind of win and yank you down, which tends to happen when you get fatigued and you're typically holding a heavy dumbbell, think of what happens there. If you're turning off the muscles, then the joints are actually bearing more of the load, and you don't want the joints to be bearing more of the load, especially in terms of the spine. You want muscles to always be doing the work for you. And so if you're getting fatigued and you just kind of let the dumbbell win and you're collapsing into that lateral flexion of the spine, that to me potentially creates a lot more potential trauma to the disc. And think of what you do if you're carrying a heavy bucket or you're walking through an airport carrying a suitcase. You don't let the suitcase win. You don't let the bucket win. You actually maintain a neutral spine while you're holding that heavy weight in one hand. The goal is to not let the weight pull you over. And I just think there's far safer and more effective ways of training the obliques and using that exercise.
Fantastic, buddy. Okay. Kind of moving on to a final point here. I guess we've talked so in depth now about core and ab training, and we've given people the tools to go out and start setting in a safe and effective program to sculpt their abs. But they're never going to see them if they're carrying too much body fat, right? So maybe we can talk about some nutrition points here of how they can actually get lean enough to be at the place where they can see all the hard work that they're putting in.
Absolutely. That's the key right there. It's an easy way to think of it, I guess, is to say that you might train once a day, but you eat several times a day. So you have more opportunity to make progress with what you're eating than by what you're doing in your exercise. And in many ways, what you're eating can influence the body's ability to even have the appropriate response that you would like to have to the training session itself. So nutrition is essential for making progress in any fitness capacity, but it's even more so with someone who wants to get body fat levels low enough to really see well-defined abdominals. And so the key thing, just at a very high level, I would like to just make sure everyone knows, is that your body builds itself out of your habits. So your first thing you want to do is look at things that you do more often. And I find people will really freak out or stress out about, oh, I had a big bowl of ice cream, you know, once last week, and it's not so much the big bowl of ice cream once in that week that might have been the problem, as much as it might have been the small little handful of candies they took out of the office candy dish every day after lunch.
Yeah.
Because that's a habit, and so those habits are what your body builds itself out of, because that's what it recognizes as what it's getting most often. And you're also creating the need for that little hit of sugar. So there's the habits are what we look for, not the single things that sometimes people tend to focus more on. Oh, I went out and drank too much with friends one night. Do that once every couple of weeks. I don't recommend it, but you know, it's one of those things where you say, okay, is that going to inhibit your progress? Probably not. It's probably the day-to-day things. And of course, most people know that are even pursuing fitness for a little while now, the goal is to just really eat just clean whole foods as much as possible, and also just try to steer clear of a lot of the heavily processed sugars and grains, because it creates a sugar-like response even if it's not sweet. So even if you're eating things like, oh, pretzels instead of potato chips, that's going to have a sugar-like response in the blood even though it doesn't taste sweet. And so we sometimes think that, oh, that's a healthier choice the whole idea is to get away from just really even having snack foods at all. And it's not easy because we live in a world that inundates us with them. So it's, but they're not really what our bodies need. And if we get rid of those, that's a good step in the right direction, because those are the ones I find that for most people, it's just eating a lot of the processed grains that are just such a huge, huge part of their day. And it can be a bagel in the morning and sort of cereal, and then they have a low quality bread sandwich for lunch, and then pasta for dinner. It just kind of, they're just pounded all day with these forms of carbohydrate that have a sugar-like effect in the blood, even if they don't taste sweet. And that's probably the one theme that I see as kind of the biggest obstacle.
Yeah, and I guess as well, what they don't realize is these foods are very calorically dense, right? So having these types of foods, you're not satisfied for long periods of time. You are packing in a lot of calories, and it's very easy for you to tip the scales and end up in a surplus, right? And you're,
that's true.
Effectively, all food is energy. Let's think about it. Everything boils down into energy, right? So eating these energy-dense foods is very easy for you to supply your body with way too much energy. And the next step for your body, what does it do when it has too much energy? Well, we know that if it's a carb, it's hard, but it will go through de novo lipogenesis, which means it's going to go get stored as a fat cell. If you do overeat carbs, then you're going to make your body really good at not using fat as a source of fuel, so you're going to become super efficient at storing fat stores, dietary fat as fat. And then we've got protein, I actually just wrote a book about this, but protein is the number one thing that I see avid, like, guys who go to the gym overeat on massively. The requirement that's actually needed is so much smaller than people think. That, again, it's you overeat something and your body has to try and use it or get rid of it somehow. It's a very interesting point. Just as you were saying, these calorically dense grain foods, it's very simple. Every time you go to that bowl of candy in the office, you're picking up 100, 200 calories at a time and putting it in. Only takes you to do that 3 or 4 times a day and have 3 meals in the day, and you are way over your energy balance.
That's well said. Yeah, it's a very true phenomenon, and I think that for many people it's a 1-2 punch in that they tend to overestimate the amount of calories they burn in a workout and then underestimate the amount of calories they might eat, specifically when eating those kind of energy-dense foods. But interesting idea you just gave me talking. It was discussing the idea of food as nutrients, and that's really a key thing. And it's funny when you look at most people's attitude about food. Most people fall into one of two camps. The hardcore fitness people are like, foods are, you know, food is just fuel. That's it. It's just carbohydrates, proteins, and fats. They just kind of eat, and they just have that mindset that food is just really it's sort of molecular components. And then there's the other people that I talk to who drive me up the wall, who say things like, oh, I'd like to eat healthier, but I just love food too much, as if I hate food. And I think we are supposed to have a little bit of both ideas in us. Yes, food is essential. It is to be viewed as the energy for giving us the ability to do all that we do in life and be able to move and think and everything. But however, we're also supposed to enjoy it. So I would challenge people who have the idea that food is just really fuel only to try to have a sense of enjoyment around eating, because it's what makes us want to eat often enough to get all the vitamins and minerals and nutrients that we need, is that we enjoy what we're eating.
Such an important point there, because the number one problem with, we don't have a weight loss problem in the world, by the way. Losing weight is super easy, right? You can lose weight in 12 weeks. People do it all the time. What we have is this issue of weight maintenance, weight loss maintenance. Okay, people cannot maintain their weight loss, because when they do start to lose weight, 90%, and this is a horrible fact, by the way, did you know 90% of people who are dieting right now will be fatter this time next year, or more overweight this time next year? 90%.
I didn't know the numbers were that high, and that's not good news, but it speaks to the tendency to almost have a very sort of moral attitude about food. And I think that's one of the things we need to stop doing is moralizing things that have no business being moralized. You're not good if you eat a healthy food. You just ate a healthy food. And you're not bad if you ate a donut. You just ate a donut.
Yeah, of course. And this is the thing, right?
It doesn't make you a bad person or a good person either way. You're just either eating in a way that moves you towards health or farther away from it.
Exactly. And like I said, it's adherence. So, I mean, Jonathan, a lot of clients that I deal with, the number one problem is that they fall off the wagon and they get in this binge-restrict cycle, right? And I've spoke about this so much on this show. But what happens is like you said, people who think of food as fuel and don't enjoy their food anymore because they're so focused on getting to a performance or a body image goal, there will usually be a massive crash, which leads to a massive amount of guilt after that crash. And that's when things start to spiral seriously out of control. So, like you said, if you are someone that thinks as food can no longer be fun or enjoyable, I would ask you to take a look at what you're doing and see if you can see yourself doing that for the next 20 years. And if the answer is no, you probably need to make an adjustment.
That's a great thing to do if you don't feel like it's if it's an enjoyable way to eat that you can sustain for a long period of time. And I have to confess, when I was getting healthy, you know, I grew up in an obese household, so I was eating a lot of sugary cereals and a lot of fast food growing up. And when I started eating healthier, I kind of had that shift where I went to the other extreme for a while. I did have that mindset of food is just fuel. It was a few years after that I really just started to realize that wasn't sustainable, kind of just more in an intuitive level. I just started to say, well, this kind of stripping away and just making food more of a mechanical kind of abstract concept really didn't feel right either. So I had to come back to the middle of having a sense of enjoyment around food while also appreciating its quality at the same time in terms of nourishing myself. So it's a very important perspective and a good place to land, and it can take some time for people to get there, but it's really valuable and, as you mentioned, very essential to say, if I can't eat this way for the rest of my life, it's probably how I shouldn't be eating now.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, dude, this has been absolutely phenomenal episode with hundreds of nuggets in there for people to take away about core training. We've spoken about the controversies of the crunch and whether it should be controversial. And we've touched on your views about that. Then we spoke about the plank and how we can make more effective use of our time rather than using a static plank, because everything in life involves movement that's enjoyable and we want to become better and safer movers. So there's probably some more effective things we could be doing there. You gave us some alternatives to the plank, and we spoke about how to build an effective core and ab training program for someone who's looking for a hypertrophic response in their training. And then we touched on some other questionable core training exercises and rounded off with some thoughts on nutrition. So can you, if there's anyone listening to this, which I'm sure there is, who think, God, this guy is like the baby Jesus of ab training, I need to know more about what he's got to offer, where can they come and find you? Where are you hanging out online? Where's your website? How do they get in touch?
Great way to summarize everything that we covered. It's hard to believe we covered all those things in the amount of time we did. Everyone can find some of my info at absrevealed.com. That's the website for the book that I wrote on ab training. It's absrevealed.com, and they can also find the book Amazon, wherever, and also there's an iPhone and iPad app as well that provides some of the exercises and videos. The website itself has a lot of videos. The website also has some videos that weren't in the book, some exercises I've come up with since. My main website is aionfitness.com, A-I-O-N, and then the word fitness.com. That's kind of the site for everything I'm doing. It's just everything I'm doing is there. It's a very, very jumbled site because I'm just doing so much right now, and I'm going to be getting that reorganized, and it's just full of everything I'm doing. And then on social media, just look for me at Jonathan Ross Fit. It's J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N-R-O-S-S, and add the word fit. That's not the Jonathan Ross that's on TV in the UK, but you just take his name and add the word fit to it, and you got me. So
fantastic. Well, listen, it's been my absolute pleasure having you on the show today, and I'm so glad that we've covered what is a very confusing topic for many people out there, whether they're beginning or they've been into the industry for a while now. Hopefully we've debunked some myths and given them some clarity on what they can take away from this podcast.
Well, it's with gratitude and honor that I express my glee with being on the show. Really honored to do it. I just love sharing information with people. I hope that was clear with everyone listening. And I just want to make sure as we close that everyone listening recognizes that not getting too bogged down in the confusing aspects of it. Just train hard, feed your body what it needs, and try not to think too much about what's right and wrong. Just kind of listen to your body a little bit more. There's millions of years of wisdom in our body if we only listen.
Oh, that's so true. Enjoyment is key, right?
Enjoyment. Well said.
Okay, buddy. So, thanks so much, and we'll catch up soon.
You're welcome.
Cheers. Bye.